Yeah, thanks a lot. Very good. Because should I ever forget to press this small button up in the left corner, please cry. And he's a real hero because he saved me 2 hours sitting in my office mumbling the stuff. Oh, welcome to the... Okay, good. Because I need to really record that. And if I don't, if there's a red button up there, please show up and tell me. Good. So welcome to this first real lecture because on Tuesday we covered mainly organizational things, and on Wednesday was reserved for the games engineering students as a introduction to their lab course and especially to the first assignment of the lab course. So today we'll be having a lecture, and tomorrow there will also be a regular lecture, so relevant for both parties in that audience here, right? The Fachschaft has actually printed my slides from last year as a script, right, that you can buy for a little money. However, I will constantly update the whole set of slides, but not, well, I'd say 85% will probably stay the same. And if you want to buy that, so there is people that would like to have things in advance. And for those that would like to have it in advance to make notes during the lecture, it's maybe a good idea to buy the script. Yeah, good. There is another thing. So for the games engineering students and the lab course, do you know that tomorrow we'll be preparing the GitHub accounts? And you know that during the first assignment, you will be obliged to do a video. And the maximum file size in that GitHub account is 100 megabytes, right? So if you should find this insufficient, please split up your video according to that 100 megabyte chunk size. Well, last word for the games engineering students. So tomorrow in the morning, I'll be fumbling. Yeah, just a second. I'll be fumbling together the remaining groups. And I've seen already that most of you are in a group of six. So for most of you, I think this procedure will be, well, transparent. There is one group with four persons and one group with a single person. Well, talk to me if you... There was a group of six that would like to be seven. I don't know if there are people among here. Okay, good. But keep on talking to me tomorrow morning, right? So there was a question, right? So his question was, would it be possible to upload the video to YouTube instead of GitHub? As a last resort, yes, but please try first to check it into GitHub, like all the stuff. So again, this is only, the whole lab course stuff is only relevant for the games engineering students. And in due time, when it comes to the exercise, it'll be relevant for all of us. Okay. So, good. That's it, right? Is there any other organizational thing that you would like to ask? Is anything unclear? So the whole lecture of last time has been uploaded to TTT, and it has been linked on Piazza, so any questions should be answered there, okay? So what are we going to do today and tomorrow? So if you remember what I told you about the topics of that lecture, we'll be dealing a lot with social media and social computing basics, right? However, for the games engineering students as well as for the social computing students, it is, part of the story to, draw some parallels between social gaming and social media. So that'll cover the first two lectures. And in the last years, so we'll start with social games, and the look on what are games, what is so social about them. That's a word of warning, right? So last year, I think those were the parts that were perceived as particularly boring by the students, as far as they told me, right? So don't let yourself be repelled by these first two lectures. It'll get more technical, more involved from a computer science perspective in the third lecture, right? So that is a word of caution, okay? Good. So let's start. So part one, introduction, social games. So the background reading for that part is actually a master's thesis of a master's student that I supervised and advised, Henry Pötzl. So the master's thesis is the background text for the stuff that I'm going to tell you. I'll upload the master's thesis to the Piazza repository. And, well, it's always the case, and that is a word of, well, advice at the beginning with all the lectures. It depends on you how you want to work with these things. So basically there is a threefold approach. So there is people among you that want to run it the minimal way, and that's perfectly fine. Okay. So it's not that I would think everyone should be totally interested in social gaming. However, for some of you, it's a mandatory course. Some others might just want the credits. However, some might want to go for the minimal approach, as I would call it. So for those that want to go for the minimal approach, my advice would be study the slides, try to read between the lines, make up your own minds, and try to answer the questions that are at the end of the slide set. So that'll be pretty much the minimal approach. However, well, experience tells you that the results would, in most cases, also be minimal. So the standard approach that I would advise or give out as an advice for the standard case is that you do the minimal case plus you read the background readings. So background reading for each lecture, there'll be one text. And the text can be a chapter out of a book. It can be a paper. It can be something like this master's thesis, which I supervised because of this lecture, right? This is like we both tried to edit and collect stuff that would cover the topics that I want to be covered. So always one background reading text, and my advice as the standard approach would be study the slides plus read the background reading text. And there is this fictionist third case, the so-called interested student. And for those, I have some additional readings that I link, and those can always come down and ask me for more advice in terms of what they should read in addition, if they want. Okay, good. So that's that. Having said that, let's start into digging into stuff. So obviously, as you know, so the games engineering students know that very well, social computing students might also. There's a lot of perspectives on digital games in general, and digital games, yeah, make for a large portion of the revenue that's generated in and around computers and the web. So this is a citation by a ludologist, and we'll get to the term ludology in a second, says that computer games are perhaps the richest cultural genre that exists, and this fact demands a search for a suitable methodological approach, okay, which makes two statements. It's a rich cultural genre. It even has this superlative in it, right? We're still missing a suitable methodological or scientific approach. Okay. So speaking of perspectives on digital games, certainly there is the gamer or player's perspective, right? You all know that probably from an early age. And then there is game designers and game developers. And I think that Gudrun Klinker did a lot of explanations on what's the difference between a game designer and a game developer. Obviously, and that's in the word, the game developer is more concerned with, yeah, well, computer science stuff, whereas the game designer does a lot of artwork and character design, storytelling, like more the, yeah, another form of creativity, right? And then there is a fourth party, and those are the academics that have games as their subject, and they're called ludologists, right? from Ludus, Latin, the game, and ludology is the, science of games. And those researchers make always, as all researchers, have to make use of a methodology, proper methodology. And foremost, these people work in an empirical fashion, meaning that their studies are done, for example, with questionnaires or by surveying market numbers, selling numbers of games, and investing games in longitudinal studies and stuff like that. Then, what is also a suitable approach that we in our group follow most of the time is so-called design science. So that's the major methodological approach in all of engineering science. So in physics, situation is clear, because in physics you have nature and you're doing experiments, try to describe nature. That's a inductive empirical science, classical science approach. So if you're a mechanical engineer or a computer scientist, this doesn't work, because you first have to invent a problem solution before you can discuss it, right? So there, at the beginning, there is the problem, and it's usually a human problem, right? And an engineer tries to maximize utility of users, right? To solve human problems. So the first step in a design science process is to discuss, manifest, and pin down the problem, which is per se a step that's not easy. Then you would devise solutions or solution components, mostly in the form of artifacts. Can be a software artifact or a hardware artifact, whatever. And then during that process, you try to develop solution components, and then you try to assess in how far those solutions can be generalized or really solve the problem that you stated in the first place, right? And this is the evaluation step, which you would then do with user studies, questionnaires, data mining on generated user content, and so on, right? Which makes you then go back to the first step, namely the design. And you keep on reiterating this until you have established a complete solution in the best case, right? And the last methodology that they might use is a mathematical deductive methodology, which goes more into the direction of game theory that we will investigate later. Of course, speaking of several disciplines that make up or that contribute to games, obviously there is the formal side, computer science, informatics, mathematics. And then there is the psychological, socio-psychological domain, which is very important for our case. And there is economy, because if you just don't sell your game, you'll be an artist that is recognized, but maybe live in poverty. So economy is an important thing. And last but not least, it's also a domain where arts and literature have their contributions, okay? And all of that, well, there is a core domain, which is indicated by those blue spheres or ellipses here. And then there's obviously economy as a science that covers a lot more issues than just these ludological issues within economy, right? And all of that comprises ludology, and the ludologist is the one that does that research, okay? Now, first and foremost, what you would try as a scientist is come up with bookkeeping concepts. And the easiest form of bookkeeping, if you want to regard a certain subject, is to describe an ordering schema, a taxonomy or something, or a classification framework. So as a classification framework for digital games, there's a lot of them out there, and we'll be discussing them in some detail. But in that master's thesis and on these slides, we'll be distinguishing two kinds of descriptive aspects, right? So the descriptive aspects of the game, and among these are, for example, the business model, the technical platform, the narrative structure, social or socio-psychological aspects, and other things like the visual design, right? Is it like more like a wireframe? Is it more like a retro style? Is it a 3D shiny with all the physics that are available on the market type of design, whatever? And these are descriptive or peripheral classification aspects, whereas in the core, we will distinguish between two things, namely the game type and the game genre. And we'll be getting to this in a few minutes. Okay? Before we do that, let's start from a very basic perspective, right? Before you can describe what a game is, or before you can start reasoning about games, I should say, you should think about what actually makes a game a game, and what's the difference between play and games, okay? Now, there is a rich body of work from several cultural historians and philosophers that try to grasp what actually is a game. That's surprisingly difficult to really pin that down. So in the late 1930s, there was this Dutch cultural historian, Huizinga, and he says that among certain things, play is something that is free, right? That is outside ordinary life, somehow not serious in a certain way, but at the same time a very absorbing, immersive activity. It doesn't follow a immediate material interest, so that it's not a profit gaining activity. And you know that there is in Korea, for example, there is large scenes of professional players, so that's becoming a bit blurred these days. It has its own boundaries of space and time. So there is the virtual concept of space and time that you all experience while interacting with these games. But at the same time, and that's important for the lab course, it'll also cross the boundary between the virtual space and the real world space. Okay, and these distinctions also become increasingly blurred. And well, obviously it follows fixed rules, and what is especially important for us, it promotes the formation of social groupings. Now, this last part of the sentence, you may have read that already, which tend to surround themselves with secrecy, that shouldn't be taken too seriously. So the interpretation is that what he wants to stress is a general tendency that's called segregation tendency, right? So there is, in socio-psychology, there is social identity theory that tries to describe how we build our social identity in terms of groups. And one important thing when doing so is distinguishing yourself via the in-group, out-group concept, right? So you're a punk, and you have, if you are a punk, you would wear like an Iroh style hairdo, or wear these leather jackets with all these pins and needles and stuff. So that's a way how you would, build your in-group and distinguish yourself. And that's also true, albeit not in that strict fashion, for certain groups of gamers. Okay. So then later in the 1960s, Roger Calois kind of took up these definitions and kind of in an attempt to pin them down more thoroughly. And you would see the parallels, right? So free, separate in time and space. And there are certain new aspects, like play is something that is uncertain in course and result. So there is some sort of randomness or game outcome there, right? If it were not, then, I mean, what would be the point, okay? Governed by rules. And then there is also this make-believe. I talk, not you, me. Thank you. So it's make-believe of a second reality, right? So we'd have this concept of a, virtual world there, okay? Good. Then he kind of pinned that down into this matrix, if you wish. Okay, so he made four columns for certain types that are pinned with these terms, like agon, alea, mimicry, and illinx, right? And then there is a second axis, which also allows us to classify. So let's look at those, right? So first column is games that have to do with competition, okay? Second is games that emphasize chance, right? And here in the competition, we have sports, classical sports games, and even martial arts and stuff like that, which are really contest competition oriented. Whereas in the chance column, we'd have things like roulette, betting, and stuff. Okay. And in the mimicry, which is something that we took up in our classification, the main focus is simulating. Right? So in the game, you simulate aspects of your true life and put them in a new, gamified context. And that goes here from child's play to even theater. And last one, which has to do with, immediate perceptive sensations, is concerned with your senses, right? So you want to stimulate your senses in a direct way, right? So by enjoying, for example, speed or the wind or something. And that's a very broad characterization of play in games, right? And there is these two different categories that divide them vertically, right? Paida and ludus, where the ludus component is more according to what we would perceive as closer to actual games, right? Well, as you see, we're progressing in time, right? In the late 1970s, Suits tried to come up with a different characterization, and it would be more final in terms of what are the goals that people would want to satisfy with games. And obviously it's always, or in most cases, about achieving a certain state of affairs. You want to get somewhere, right? In an ego shooter, you want to finish the campaign. In Mensch ärgere dich nicht, you just want to win against other players. And that he calls the pre-lucery goal. And what's also important, using only the permitted rules, that is by lucery means. And what's important here is that the rules are not always, emphasizing new affordances, but also limitations. And if you remember what I told you last Wednesday about limiting factors that can boost your creativity, this is one of the essential features of games. You limit your users, right? Because that allows the mind to grasp to these structures and then build new worlds, right? And the acceptance of those rules is due to something that he calls the lucery attitude, right? Without this attitude, games and play wouldn't be possible. Okay. In the 1990s, and we're about to finish this in a second, there is Sutton Smith. He says, okay, other aspects, play as progress, which is especially true for the way small children play, right? They don't play ego shooters. They just fumble around in order to make progress with their bodies, with their senses, with their mechanical abilities. It's also a form of playing, right? And it is more geared towards developing skills and elementary skills, okay? Then play as fate, which is certainly true for gambling, right? And that's something that people that really like to play roulette or stuff find intriguing, and which makes them addicted to these things. Then conflict play as power is something that is especially important for social games, obviously, right? People want to win over others, okay? And the fourth one, which has been framed blue, because I frame all these points blue that are especially important for social gaming, is play as an identity. And again, we're having this community building function of play and playing, right? So it's about communities of participating players, okay? Then, obviously, there's three more points, and he calls play as the imaginary, right? Which appeals to your imagination. Again, this emphasize of play of the self, so these desired experiences, fun, relaxation, stuff like that, and there is certain types of fun that we're going to investigate, and the last one, which he calls play as the frivolous, so just playing around. Yeah, so there is the most extreme form of casual gaming, like playing around with your pen or with a chain or something. Yeah, good. So what we see is that obviously from all these definitions, how relevant or irrelevant they may be for us, obviously playing and game as two concepts are not the same, right? So being in a playful mind is a prerequisite for people to play games. And games can somehow be tools that allow people to play. And both concepts are intimately linked in a very, logically intricate way, right? Second thing that we might take home from that, there's always in playing and games, there's a social aspect inherent. Even in the most nerdy ego shooter, there are a lot of motives that are taken up from social life, right? So it's about shooting other persons, right? As far as this is social, right? But it's a social act in some sense, okay? However, the simulation games, World of Warcraft, all these things have their social groupings which form alongside of the game and which have to do with identity building in one form or another, right? If a game is very successful for a certain person, then it will take up a lot of his or her time, okay? So, besides those philosophical perspectives, we can look at play and game from the other party's perspective as well, right? So from the player's perspective, which we will largely exclude, and from the game researcher's perspective, and from the game developer and designer's perspective, okay? So let's start with the game researcher's perspective, okay? So, one very interesting book that you might be interested to read is by Salen and Zimmerman from 2004, and I don't know if they have a new edition out, and they cover a lot of these aspects, and we relied heavily in parts on this book, right? So their take on this distinction between play and game is that of a set hierarchy. So being playful in a playful state of mind comprises the largest category, which is the superset of ludic activities, right? So including all non-core game behaviors of play, for example, is mimicry and Illing's category of Kalua. And this is the superset, again, of actual gameplay, as we would try to investigate here, right? So formalized interaction, following rules, and producing a certain experience with the help of a system, which is, for our case, is mostly an AP system, okay? So they came up with a different definition of game. So it's a system, and we won't go into system theory here. So we stick to our intuitive understanding of what is a system, which engages the player, which does so in an artificial conflict, that's defined by rules. And what they find is that it's resulting in a quantifiable outcome, right? In a number of points, in someone that won, all these things are subsumed by quantifiable outcome. Well, that's one definition. Hunicke, again, same time, says that games are systems that build behavior via interaction. That's more like a behaviorist style of perception. But what's interesting for us is that interaction is the magic word that is emphasized. Okay? So even, again, even in the most single player campaign game, there is interaction with non-player characters and other mimicry of real life. Either it's simulated or there is true other players. But it's in most cases about interaction. So gameplay, as defined by Dormans, is the emergent property of the game as defined by its rules. Okay, good. What does that mean? So emergence as a theory emphasizes that phenomena of a system are such that they cannot be understood in detail by the characteristics of its constituents. So one important example is like a beehive as an organism, right? You know, bees are comparatively primitive animals compared to an ape, like a human, yeah? And the things that this species can produce. So the individual animal's behavior seems rather simple, but the beehive as an organism is rather complex, right? And the relation between the constituents' properties and the properties of the superorganism is at best unclear. Okay? So you know that they have certain dance patterns where they signalize other bees where the food is, but in how far the whole organism is organized and how they know when to stop building the nest or so is still subject to research. And what Dormans emphasizes is that we are always dealing with emergent properties. So if you're designing a game, a game system, especially a social game, in those cases, it's the real asset is not the landscape or the server or the code. The real asset is the user community, right? And that is already an emergent property of that whole game. Right, so World of Warcraft, to stress that again, lives by its community. And you have to build strategies or create strategies to come up with such a community, otherwise the whole thing would be worthless. Okay? So, Tail and Zimmerman emphasize some other criteria. Well, emergent we had, uncertainty we had. What they also regard is games as games of, as information theoretical systems. Okay? So who has heard of information theory? Hands up. Good. Who has never heard of this? Okay. Again, who doesn't care? Interesting. Good. Good. So, information theory, it's rather simple. So what you want is, so you have a probability space of some sort, and what you want is to come up with a measure of how informative a certain event actually is. Okay? So you're seeking for a measure I that kind of maps that probability space to the real numbers. Okay? And there is very few criteria that you would want to have. Okay, so first criterion is the less probable something is, an event, the more informative it is, right? So if I tell you there are students sitting outside in the sun, you would say, very nice. Yeah? If I tell you aliens have just landed on Marienplatz, you would say, Jesus, yeah, aliens, really serious. And that's because the probability is much lower, right? So what we want is that the information is higher, the lower the probabilities. Criterion number one. Second criterion, if you are having two independent events, yeah, stochastically independent events, like event one and event two, right? And you're seeking the information of the fact that both of these things occur together, like in this fashion, what you would want is that the information measure just sums up, okay? If you have two independent knowledge sources, the information that you get by having two parts of information should be just the sum of both information, right? And that already tells you that the information goes as, if you have the probability of some event, goes as the logarithm of that probability, okay? Because only the logarithm has that property, okay? And then you can normalize this according to the power or the base of the logarithm. And normally in information theory, people take the base 2. And then you can say an event with a certain probability has an information of, let's say, 2, and the unit is bits, yeah? Because you choose the basis of 2. And one important notion is, if you have a whole probability distribution of basic events, then you build the expectation value of that. What you get is entropy, right? So the entropy would be like some pi, log to the basis 2 of pi. And you would add a minus sign to fulfill requirement number one, namely that the information should be inversely proportional to the probability, okay? And that induces a whole lot of interesting things, so probabilistic or entropy-based classifiers or clustering algorithms, all these things. And games can be analyzed in that fashion. That's why they made that point of information theory, right? Then there are systems of information, which maybe together with this second to last point already points to game theory, right? So in game theory, as we will cover at the end of the lecture, what you have is a number of contestants or players which have their utility functions specified according to states of affairs of the environment of the game. And now the question is, and they have certain alternatives that they can play, and that gives us, as we will see, a game matrix. And now the question is, how are they going to rationally play, right? And that leads to Nash equilibrium as one important concept. And that's also part of games, right? They are cybernetic systems, which points us to multi-agent systems, yeah? And they are also systems of conflict, which may point even to political theory in the end. So, social aspects of games, right? Mostly by Sale and Zimmerman, three sites, okay? When games are framed as social play, the relationship between elements in the game system are considered to be social relationships, okay? So that's very important to us, because social relationships will be at the heart of this lecture, okay? And second citation, they stress that games are emergent social systems, again, framing this or using that concept of emergence, and in that sense that I already explained, right? Resulting in incredibly complicated experience of play. And last point, what they understand by so-called transformative social play is that players take the game world that you design and make their own stories up around that, in that, with that. Okay? And that is something that will be especially interesting also for social media, because a wiki is something that's incredibly simple, because that's just a website that you can edit. Period. It's nothing. If there's no content in it, and if there's no culture behind that, it's nothing. Okay? Stack Overflow has its own transformative social play rules, right? So you have to adhere to the rules to be not classified as a troll or someone. So players extend, transform, and manipulate existing social relationships through and with the play itself, right? That's an important point that we will take up in later considerations, okay? Good. Now you might say, okay, good. We've had a lot of a lot of definitions of play in games. So what then is not a game? So if you go declare everything a game, computer science, whatever, history, then it's a bit pointless, right? And that's true. So Jasper Juul came up with this diagram where he tries to pin down what he considers games, borderline cases, and non-games, right? So in that core circle, which looks like an orange or something that you cut in half. So we have rules, variable outcome, valorization. So in terms of this quantifiable outcome, player effort, attachment, and, well, consequences, however negotiable they might be. And that he considers aspects of true games. And then there is these borderline cases where he subsumes this skill-based gaming and pure chance-based gaming, where, for example, the negotiated consequences are different than in games, pen and paper, role-playing, and all these things, and even games of pure chance. So because then there is no effort which is required, yes? Well, I perceive that not as a counter argument, right? So that's at least they have fixed rules, right? It's not a contradiction. Yeah, that's right, but this is like an informal diagram. So he should have distinguished it more in terms of pro and contra arguments, as far as I perceive. However, certain in pen and paper role playing, nobody can deny that you somehow have fixed rules. So that cannot be a counterpoint. So but you're right. This is certainly a bit fuzzy in that diagram. Yes? It could also be an aspect of interpreting this diagram, right? But however, I mean, what you should do is try to come up with other borderline cases. So consider the definitions that were given on the other slides and try to devise maybe your own judgment about what is actually a game in the sense that you want to pin down, or what is a borderline case. So I'm totally with you when you say this is, well, you can discuss that. So it's not fixed, right? That there is no true theory behind that. And that's the great weakness at this point, that ludology is a bit of a fuzzy thing at this moment in time, right? And well, in rules universe, there is certainly this fear of things that are not considered true games, while, according to our previous definitions, they have certainly aspects of playfulness and all the other criteria that we have. So what we take home from this and your comments is that nothing here is fixed in stone, right? These are just things that are true as a tendency, but it's very hard to come up with a consistent definition for actually what a game is and where the boundaries are. Good. Okay, we can maybe skip that. Too many definitions. Okay, so good. Let's stick to another one, Frasca, which is also a ludologist. So what he frames is that games are by default social endeavors, right? And that even, as I already said, single gaming is always framed by social concepts. And that this valorization of the outcome in very many cases is measured and valued according to certain social standards or according to certain social status, right? So again, we're having components of games that are actually emphasized to be social, okay? The other things we already know, right? Play, rules, make believe, game consequences that are not optional and stuff like that, right? And one citation here, any activity can be a game, but not every activity is a game, which is somehow contradictory, but it tells you that as with playing games, it's very hard to come up with a definite definition. Okay. Good, so let's leave behind this field of definitions and look at players. Yeah, so player types. And as you can imagine, at least the persons that play the games are more accessible from a scientific perspective. Because you can do studies with them, you can ask them, you can do demographics, statistics, you can characterize player types. Okay? So, again, there's a lot of systems of classification where you can sort people into. Yule came up with a very simple, but I think very widely accepted distinction, namely between so-called hardcore players and casual players. And that we will take up in our meta types of games, where hardcore games and casual games are actually types or meta types. Okay? And I think both terms are intuitively clear, whereas, again, a hard boundary between those two player types is hard to draw. It's hard to draw a line when someone makes the transition from hardcore to casual, or it's even possible that people are hardcore players and casual players at the same time, right? Only that they interact with games in both styles at different times and places. Now, taking up this lucery attitude that we had some slides ago, Zale and Zimmerman distinguish some typical player types, right? So in terms of how their lucery attitude is like, right? So the standard player is certainly someone that wants to follow the rules, and whereas very dedicated player kind of tend to extend that. They tend to develop at least unusual gameplay strategies to, well, come up or conquer certain obstacles. Then there is the unsportsmanlike players that may follow the rules in a more technical sense, but violates this lucery spirit in a certain sense, right? So you need to kind of take up the game designer's story, follow that with your lucery attitude to really let things live, whereas people like that would kind of tend to destroy this social environment. And then there is the cheater, which even violates the rules, and then the spoilsport, which is not really a player, but someone that is just a hooligan, in a sense, a troll, okay? Good. So, as I said, player types are, well, they lend themselves well to as being subject to statistics, and there's a lot of study on or a lot of studies on games and players. And for example, well, it's not so surprising that 72% of US households play digital games. But what's maybe more surprising is that we are very strongly heading to a equal basis in gender, right? So the cliche that only male nerds sit in their darkened chambers and play shooters is certainly not true nowadays, because almost half of the players are female, and casual play is, even the most predominant form of playing today. That's how the money is made in the industry, right? So mobile is a growing field, obviously, and 65% play together with other players or gamers in person, right? So we see that the field of social games is becoming more prominent over time. And, last thing is a bit strange. Adult gamers have spent 12 years of constantly playing video games. Don't know if that's really true, but if it is, interesting. Yes? So I cannot. So the question, just for the recording, the question was, how did they actually prove that? Is it assumed to be 12 years of 24/7/365 life, or is it like normal professional life in terms of you play 8 hours a day? I don't know. However, I mean, it's just a factor of three. So even if it were only this 8 hours, it would be like 4 years of continuous 24-hour play, right? However you take it, it's a large time span, right? And I don't know how they prove it, but these things, they use also indirect statistical reasoning, obviously, because they just cannot monitor players all the time. However, and that's studies that are really done, for example, at MIT, they play people to carry around devices to survey them 24 hours, right? And I was once at a conference where there was a rather famous AI scientist from MIT Media Lab. Yeah, I'll see you just a second. And he had a wife, and the wife was a child psychologist or child development scientist. And what they agreed to do was to video capture their flat, their apartment, and record the audio for 24 hours a day, 365, for 3 years. And what they wanted to have is a data set that would document their child growing up and acquiring language. Right, so obviously we know that there is a process from babbling and mama, papa, and then they start to speak their first sentences, but they just wanted to have quantitative data. And so they had every room in their apartment surveyed for 24 hours. I mean, okay, if you properly filter out, okay, good, whatever. Right, so the point here was these are not very statistically not very precise numbers. So these are, yeah. So obviously, and so your suggestion was, if you're having a game, what you can do is monitor the interaction of the players much more closely than that. And that's a field I really want to suggest to you, that data mining in your players' activities can teach you a lot, right? And from what I have experienced with game companies, they are not really doing that very intensively these days. I think that's an upcoming thing, yeah? But this is certainly a field where you can apply the techniques from this lecture, okay? Good. So, what are components of digital games? Okay. So, obviously, first thing is we need rules. Okay. So, rules are there to limit the player actions. They are explicit. and unambiguous. They're shared, they're fixed, they're binding, and they're repeatable in a certain sense, right? They distinguish three types of rules, right? So first are the constitutive rules. So they make up the core logic of the game, right? What the game is actually about. Then operational rules, which deal with external events. And what's more interesting from a social perspective are the implicit rules. So the game culture that emergently in transformative play emerges from, yeah, what people find, okay? Which is also largely and partially and largely dependent on external context, like, for example, the platform. Good. So, obviously, what rules define is a chain of dependencies, right? Limitations, affordances, okay? And what you and colleagues define is that, in a sense, what rules map is the player's actions to game states, right? So that's the classical view on games as a state machine, okay? So that's a graph or a tree where you have transitions, which are the edges, and that's something that is classically implemented in a text adventure game, right? So if you're in a state, you're having a limited set of actions, okay? And, well, something that also points into the direction of game theory is that on each state, or in each state, you have a certain utility function. And this designation of utility functions is something that is very popular or a standard modeling tool in multi-agent systems and game theory, because robots and agents would try to, in the first place, try to maximize their utility. And depending on the utility function and the state landscape, it's very hard to come up with strategies that optimize utility gain, right? However, it should lead to an enjoyable experience. So, then there's this paper by Parlett, which I took out this diagram from. So he came up with a whole typology of rules, right? He distinguishes laws, behavioral rules, operational rules, written rules, a lot of different ones. And, well, the take-home message is, so if you're interested, there's a more detailed description in here. However, what is also apparent from this diagram is that there is rules that are kind of core parts of the system, and then there's these emergent cultural developments, right? So these things that people produce while interacting with a game or a social medium. And these are the things that are interesting or especially interesting from this social play perspective. Okay? Good. Now, well, what are other components? Certainly, ludologists want to be as general as possible. So Hunicke came up with their framework where they distinguish game mechanics, game dynamics, and game aesthetics. Okay, so game mechanics—that's certainly that is certainly a very common term in ludology, and it describes the various actions, behaviors, and control mechanisms that are possible. Okay, so this is what really makes the statical basis or the foundations of the game, the really what's possible, what type of interaction is possible. Okay. Then the dynamics. So if you have these mechanical structures, how are they used during runtime, right? So how does the runtime behavior of the mechanics manifests itself and acts on the player's inputs. And last is clear, aesthetics is the structures that contribute to facilitating an emotional response. Okay, so if the game just looks ugly, it won't be immersive, it just won't drag you in, and it won't stimulate these social interactions that we are after. Okay? Good. So other Ludologists come up with other axes of game elements, right? So, yeah, Jawinen, for example, they would distinguish, for example, the components, so the resources that you actually need from the environment. And the environment is something that we will regard, or we will have to regard in a special way. If we want to blur the transitions between the physical world and the actual game world in itself, and that's especially relevant for social play, right? Good. Other things, the compound elements, as you can see, the rule set, game mechanics, the theme, so the subject matter. Interface is something that they mention, so what's the UI like? And they also describe games from an informational perspective, games as systems of information. And if you want to model it like that, the states are closely coupled with the information that all the players have at a certain time. And it's clear that dealing with informing and not informing players about certain things is a key element of games, right? If you would just lay out all the information, then it would certainly not contribute to immerse the players, okay? And then there's these behavioral aspects or behavioral elements, right? Which deals with the players and, again, the spatiotemporal time and space environment of the gameplay, right? And here we have the social interaction, which is either inside the game, following the game mechanics, the game rules, but also outside. So building guilds and clans and friendship circles, and that's also something that we want to investigate, okay? And they also come up with a definition of game mechanics, right? Particular set of rules available to the player, right? In form of prescribed casual relations between game elements and their consequences to particular game states, right? So what are your actions? What are the states that you can achieve? And what's the relation between those elements, right? Now, as a last point for today, we'll be going deeper into what I promised you, the types and meta-types of digital games, okay? So, going back to the first slide, that was where we started from, this slide. So, here, we're now dealing with meta-types and types and genres. That will be one perspective of how you can actually classify games, okay? Good. But let's first start with meta types. And as we will see, right, so meta aims at a higher level of abstraction, a certain game would or could be attributed at least in part to certain meta types of that sort, right? So it's not that they are mutually exclusive. And what we can distinguish, that's just a suggestion, is that we can distinguish between simulation games, social games, online games, and mobile games, whereas location-based make a subset here, okay? Obviously, as I said, these meta types are overlapping, right? So it's certainly possible to be a simulation and a social game at the same time. And they're probably not complete. So if you have a suggestion of how to extend this, so this was to the best of our knowledge that we tried to come up with. But if you have a suggestion, please tell me, right? Let's look at these meta types, okay? So simulation games. Good. So, obviously, what is part of, or a central part of the game is you simulate something that exists outside of the game. So, to simulate is to model a source system, something out of real life, spaceships, social interaction, shooting somebody, whatever. Possibly non-real, but existing outside of the game. which somehow maintains some of the original modeled systems aspects and behaviors, but kind of extends them. So a simulation in the game sense is not a true physical simulation, such as those that are run on these large cuboidal computers outside there that simulate the universe and its origins from the Big Bang, but more a fictionist version, okay? And this simulation is obviously closely related to game mechanics and especially game physics, right? So what goes under the name of game physics is nothing but the actual simulation of physical reality, albeit in a reduced and efficient form. So in the end, it's about giving you a true, a realistic experience without being physically 100% accurate, at least not necessarily so. Right? Good. So that those are simulation games. And that's pretty clear. Like even an ego shooter does simulate the real life situation of running around with a rifle. It's clear what is meant by that, I think. So social games require social interaction. So that is necessarily something that is multiplayer, while the multiplayer interaction does not have to be synchronous. It can also be asynchronous. So that, for example, you post something somewhere, some other person finds it. So typical form of asynchronous game-like, social game-like interaction is geocaching. People place the geocaches somewhere, other people try to find them, note down that they found them, and so on, right? And again, we're having these emergent cultural behavioral things emerging from this very simple idea, okay? So this social interaction can either be cooperative or competitive, but both can be the case. It can be that the social interaction is actually in the game or happening outside the game, mediated through the game, which is a form of interaction that is not yet that prominent, but I think may grow over the next years. And what's very important is that it generates and uses social context. Now, what's social context? So social context is something, is a key term of that lecture, which will guide us through a lot of lectures, right? And I already talked about this, I guess, in the first lecture, if I'm not completely mistaken. So context is everything or all the information about an interaction of a user with a system, okay, that can be used inside the system to the benefit of the user. And we'll distinguish basically two forms of social context. That is long-term social context, social relations, kinship, friendship, all these things that will lead us to social networks and social network analysis. And then short-term social context that will lead us to social signal processing and all these things that are comparatively short-term. Okay? Good. So, online games, well, something that happens in the online world requiring connectivity, typically browser games, web-based browser games, are certainly one other meta type, right? Well, then there is the meta type of mobile games, and I think I talked about this, it was in the second session for the gamers. What does mobile really mean, right? So mobile does not necessarily mean that a game is run on a smartphone, right? Because that's just another UI. And if you look at modern smartphones like one of these Samsung devices, oh, I must make a phone call. Yeah? Hello? Yeah? You know these. I mean, there's practically the difference between a Samsung Galaxy smartphone and a tablet and a modern whatever MacBook Air, it's becoming blurred, right, in a certain sense. There's still these classes of devices, but how would you want to tell if something is truly mobile? Is something that runs on a laptop mobile? Well, you can carry it around, at least in theory, but it's not truly mobile, right? So the UI does play a role, but the most important distinguishing element is that something is truly mobile if it uses the mobile context that is generated by being mobile. And among that, I would understand all the individual and social context that is generated through sensors that are attached to the device that you carry around, which produce data that can then be used in the application or the game. Right? One typical example is location. If you run around with a smartphone, the GPS sensor always knows, produces data where you are, and this is data that you can then use in the game or the application. And that is the only truly mobile setting. Okay? So games that make use of spatial context, which is a subset of mobile context, we would want to call location-based games, okay? There's other forms and classifications of context like spatiotemporal, social, physical, individual, personal, medical, health, whatever. All these things that can function as context. Now, the differentiating element between a contextual element and just another input element is that for the game or the application, input elements are truly necessary to fulfill their function, whereas context elements are something that's beneficial, right? Essential, beneficial. And the boundary between that is also blurred, of course. Okay? Good. Now, these were the meta types. Again, simulation, social, online, mobile, and as a subset of mobile will be regarding location-based. Okay? Good. Now, having these meta types, we would also have types. Okay? While the meta types are clearly non-exclusive, the types are intended to be, not totally exclusive, but more exclusive than the meta types. And we will be presenting a matrix connecting those two things at the same time, right? So I would propose to distinguish the following types of games. Hardcore games, casual games, pervasive, and serious games. Okay? Again, they are not fully exclusive, but more so than the meta types. And again, this list is also probably not complete. If you want to have another type there, please discuss. Okay? So, starting with hardcore games, so we've been talking about hardcore players. Obviously, there must be a counterpart in the games. How can they be characterized, right? So, the corresponding meta types are typically simulation, right? So, an ego shooter is a hardcore game, and it's predominantly a simulation game. And less so, but also present here, is that they can be online or even social, right? There is people that spend a lot of time with World of Warcraft, for example. One characterizing element is that we are talking about really intensive player immersion, right? So players are really sucked into that virtual world a lot, okay? And, popular subtypes are shooters, massively multiplayer online ego shooters, massively multiplayer online games, role-playing games, multi-user dungeons, even some vintage classic Atari arcade-style games were very hardcore, at least when I was young, right? In 1980-something, I thought that Space Invaders was a God-given thing, right? It was so cool. My neighbor had Space Invaders, and I didn't, and it was yeah, one of my childhood tragedies. It was such a super cool game, so fascinating. With these Atari joysticks, you know them? No, you don't. It's probably long before you were born. Okay, good. Often they have realistic physics, often 3D, detailed game worlds, all the stuff that you know. Okay. Contrast are casual games, right? So they are designed for instant play, so they should be easy to learn. And as the saying goes, easy to learn, hard to master. So they should still pose some difficulties to the players. For example, Tetris is an example, like an old game, right? It's easy to learn, but it's in the larger, later stages, it's hard to master. Quick play, right? So the pleasure is something that should come very quickly. And if you play an ego shooter, you know that normally you would have to do this training level and then you would run around in the first level, see where the enemies are. It takes more time. And casual is quick play, right? Common play is that it addresses a lot of player types, yeah? So even hardcore players can be fans of casual games, but the other direction is normally not very true, right? Meta types are primary online games, social, which is another, which is the second main axis for casual, and also to a large extent mobile. And yes, so there's a constant development in casual games, so they're quickly put on the market, whereas these hardcore games take longer production cycles. So, Jewell describes five design principles for casual games, right? So first is that the fiction in casual games is always, or in most cases, fiction with a positive valence, right? So it's in least cases, it's about true violence and blood and bursting heads and stuff. Yeah? It's more like about birds and flowers in many cases, right? Easy to use, friendly interfaces, and they presuppose little previous knowledge. They're easy to learn, right? They're interruptible in that players can play in bursts, right? So you're playing like Angry Birds, then your boss comes in, you quickly hit the button, Excel reappears on the screen, the boss goes out, you return to Angry Birds. So that's the usual scenario with casual games. They are easy to learn but difficult to master, meaning that the level of difficulty gradually rises through while playing the game, but the punishments are comparably mild, right? So they're not intended to really play with frustration a lot, okay? So these hardcore shooter type games use player frustration in a certain way to attract them and to challenge them, whereas this is not the case typically in casual. And this is subsumed by the term they are juicy, right? So you need to have a certain juiciness. So even excessive positive feedback for comparatively small successes and, yeah, well, positive overall state of affairs, right? Now, what are varieties of casual games? Obviously, you know, browser games, like web applications, the whole array by Zynga. I don't know if they still are active. Social networking games, popular example is Farmville, played on social networking platforms like Facebook or so. Downloadable casual games like, yeah, well, Mohun used to be something which was popular like 5, 6, 7 years ago, which was introduced by a whiskey company, I think, and excessively played these days. You need to download it. Was not a web casual game, but nevertheless in the same style. And then what goes under the name mimetic games, right? All these things that are played with Wii, Kinect, require a lot of physical interaction outside of the normal UI elements, right? And that's interesting for us because it's a means and a product of social signal processing. You know, like Kinect, for example, is a very simple algorithm, but yet a very intelligent one. And the guys at Microsoft do an incredible job in visual computing and detecting movements and gestures and stuff. Yes? Flappy Bird. Don't know that. Okay, good. I'm old, guys. Okay. 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 Good. So the point from the audience was that it was a counter argument to what I said about not being so frustrating. What he says is that Flappy Birds, I don't know, yeah, most of you know that, is a game that deals heavily with frustration. And another observation by you was that mobile games also tend to become more difficult and play more with frustration, right? Good. And that's, well, it's a trend and a counter trend. Obviously, if you just go on with all these juiciness and flowers and Candy Crush, blah, 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 people would become bored with that. So that's maybe a counter trend. But in the end, it's a different kind of frustration, maybe. It's more like a skill-based frustration. Can I master these things? It's maybe different from the frustration that arises in a shooter where you just cannot complete the level because there's a lot of zombies running at you and you just don't know where the magic thing is that would help you, right? It's more like a story-based frustration in those, whereas here we're talking about skill-based frustration, which still adheres to these other demands like burstiness, interruptibility, and so on, right? Which is important because you need to be able to just quickly click it away while when your station has arrived in the subway and you need to get out, right? That's the casualness. But one important point about your counter arguments is, as I said, nothing of this, of these insights is just framed in stone. It's just tendencies, right? And it's very hard to come up with a reliable classification system for games that would really stand for several years. That's why I presented you all this timeline from the philosophers, because it shows you how the perspective just changed by having digital games at all, right? And we're still in the process, so I can only advertise you also becoming a ludologist, at least the games engineering students, and not only a game designer, right? And the social computing students, well, ludology is part of social computing as well, right? Good. Yeah, well, then we had casual, now we're talking about pervasive, right? So, what are pervasive games? And there is a citation again. So a pervasive game is a game that has one or more salient features that expand the contractual magic circle of play spatially, temporally, or socially, right? So what's meant by the contractual magic circle of play? So game mechanics and rules and all the other components are designed to immerse you into the game, right? And in that game, we can talk about the game world, the setting in which the game takes place. That's what Juul understands by contractual magical circle. Contractual because it's, well, mediated by the game's mechanics and rules. So that's the contract between you as a player and the rules and the mechanics and the design. And it's a magic circle because it has all these elements of immersion, fantasy, yeah, fulfilling the needs you express by being playful or via being playful, right? And pervasive games are games that, yeah, in one or more features expand that circle. So they're the games that incorporate real life. And in general computer science or informatics, this also goes by the name of cyber-physical systems. Yeah? So systems that blur the boundary between the cyberspace and the physical space. And that's especially important for the social aspect of games, because they mediate social interactions in the game and also outside of the game in the true world. Yeah. So the question was, is real life role playing, live action role playing, is that part of that concept? Yeah, those people that run around with real iron swords and real helmets and stand in woods and keep watch and stuff like that. Well, your counter argument was that there is no cyber component in there, right? And I would agree to that. So that's certainly not part of our consideration as computer scientists, but certainly they're one end of the story, whereas pure cyber systems are the other end. And what's interesting here is the boundaries in between. So if you have augmented reality components, so if you're like talking about medieval swords and dragon style game, yeah, you can run around with these helmets and swords, but the dragons you need, you might have to add with augmented reality. I don't know. Yeah. And that you might bookkeep some of the social relations just by phoning someone. Let's go out in the woods and have fun role playing, right? But you can also do that via social networking, finding other players, having communities there. And that's where the interesting blurred boundary comes in again. Okay? Good. So you might have already, while we led this discussion, you might have already read all these other terms. So Montola, the one with the definition, came up with synonyms or part synonyms for pervasive games. And there are a lot of them, right? Immersive games, cross-media games, geo-games, like geocaching, context-aware games, again, context awareness, as I referred to, augmented reality games, ambient games, trans reality games. So these all point in the same direction. And it's clear that context is important, right? Because context is the thing that comes in, or the information that comes in from the real world. Okay? And, well, that's a viewpoint that sees the virtual game as the first order citizen, and the other thing is the expansion. So you may come from the other direction. So real life is the first order thing, and then we'd have to augment this with virtual components. It's also possible. Okay? Good. Well, other definitions or other characterizations for pervasive? Now, on the threshold between tangible and immaterial space, right? May include wearable, mobile, or embedded software to facilitate a natural environment for gameplay, right? So what's in there is you need the actors and the sensors that kind of connect the IT world with the real world, right? If you don't have that, there is no true amalgamating these two things, okay? What's certainly related is the concept of pervasive and ubiquitous computing, right? So both terms, ubiquitous computing is maybe more geared towards having or providing any service at any time and place, which has a heavy overlap with mobile computing, whereas pervasive computing aims at things like the Internet of Things, right? So having every screw equipped with an IPv6 address, right? And then doing swarm intelligence and all these nice things, right? So in Internet of Things, you might have heard that topic is an upcoming thing. which has its clear cross sections with pervasive. Right? And the related meta types are naturally mobile and location based, but also secondarily social, because the social interaction in the true world and its, well, shadowing into the virtual is something that's really important. Okay? Has a lot of subtypes, for example, smart toys. Yeah, Tamagotchi for small children. You might know this thing by Ravensburger, where you combine books and real interaction with the true printed books with sound processing. Well, effective gaming is something that is a key word, right? Measuring the social, the emotional state of users. We will get to this in more detail later. Tabletop games, like, well, placing tangible objects on, multi-touch tables, for example. There's a whole group that's called Tangible Computing at MIT Media Lab. Who has ever been to MIT Media Lab? They're still among the most crazy and most creative guys out there. There's one group that dealt with tangible computing. Location-aware, like geocaching, and augmented reality, right? To gamification we will cover later, okay? Good. So, I think we're already running out of time. There's one last or two last types. So let me quickly in two sentences sum that up and see where we're heading tomorrow, right? So, first, the pragmatics. Why did we discuss all these things and what would I expect you to make out of this, okay? So, the story is certainly that social media and social games will be treated on equal footing in this lecture, in a certain sense, and we need to come from the gaming side for the games engineering students as well as for the social computing students. Now, that's one aspect of this pragmatics, right? And we'll continue this in a slightly shorter form tomorrow, for those that want to come, and then we will go into things that are maybe more interesting for the whole audience, namely social media and all its facets. However, one question that you might find interesting now is, how would I expect you to interact with that, right? So there were a lot of slides, a lot of definitions, a lot of things that you could think about, but would I really have to think about? My advice is minimal approach. Take the slides and make up your minds about the definitions. Be critical, right? If you don't agree, think about why you don't agree and what's the essence of you, of what you just saw. Normal or standard approach would be to read the respective sections in that master's thesis, which is well written. That's the background text. And again, make up your minds. Be critical. See where you agree, where you don't agree. What's your take-home message? And third, try to answer the questions. Now, what I will do is I will usually take out this first chapter, social games, out of the curriculum for the exam. Yeah, because people kept on telling me, we're bored, we just don't want to learn Huizinga's definition of game. That's a bit strange. Yeah, but what I really want you to do is to think about these issues, right? Make up your minds. It'll be good for both parties here, right? So tomorrow we'll be finishing that, and if we're done, we're digging into the social media parts and the more mathematical, more formal modeling issues, right? So see you tomorrow. For those that don't want to come, see you next week, right?